I did.
Gary put down his half-eaten slice of pizza. The man kept records of everything and filed dozens of letters, many of them poison pen letters. He had evidently been hounded for many years, accused of bringing about the death of an innocent man. I think it was just irritating to begin with, as it rather comes with the territory. But Seaton's wife died suddenly, and not long after his only son went off to Australia to work. At this point, the threats intensified, and under pressure, Seaton cracked. He gave up work and moved away. He began using his middle name and refused to speak to anyone from his past. He emerged as Bernie, the recluse of Harlan Marsh. But his nemesis found him, Robbie added somberly. He did, Gary snatched a bite of pizza. Even though he was ex-directory, he started getting phone calls. I know this because he kept a diary for a while. Sadly, he gave up just before his persecutor's first visit, or I'm sure we would have a description to match the one his neighbour gave us, and our snout Cassie's.
Any suggestions as to why Seaton finished up on the streets?
Asked Max.
That's the weird part. After all, even though he was a recluse and a bit on the odd side, he still dressed really well and was careful with his appearance.
Rosie laughed.
Still thinking about that awesome haircut?
Yeah, he had values. He was no spring chicken, but he took care of himself.
And his house, added Gary. Apart from the articles that were destroyed, the place was immaculate. And he had some smashing gear, too. Lovely paintings, beautiful ornaments, and really classy furniture. Would you say his surroundings were important to him, Gary? Jackman asked. Very much so, sir. Jackman nodded. Then maybe that's how the killer manipulated him. Robbie looked up from his food.
Like, threatened to torch the place, something like that?
Possibly, Jackman said. His wife and son were gone, and his possessions were all he had left.
But surely that wouldn't cause you to kill yourself, Charlie asked. I mean, I completely understand if your kids are threatened, but belongings can be replaced.
Don't forget that this was a sustained psychological attack over a very long time. Who knows what state his mind was in by the time he died?
True, I hadn't thought of that.
Charlie picked up his pizza, then put it down again.
Do you think he had OCD?
Jackman shrugged. Gary, you've seen his house, what do you think? Gary frowned.
I didn't think of it at the time, but yes, quite possibly. I said immaculate, but it was really almost too perfect. A place for everything and everything in its place, as they say.
Charlie grinned.
Then you are right, sir. A threat to his perfect home might really get to him. Just mess up his sock drawer and he'd probably feel like topping himself.
Jackman tried not to smile. A tad on the callous side, Charlie, but I catch your drift.
It would take a master manipulator and a lot of patience to carry off something as insidious as that,
Robbie interjected.
Sir, do you know the history of the Ashcroft murder? Was the convicted man's guilt ever in doubt?
No. His DNA was everywhere at the scene, and with two eyewitnesses identifying him under oath, it was pretty well cut and dried.
But the family never doubted his innocence, even with all that damning evidence.
Robbie looked perplexed. Tomorrow we will go over the whole transcript together. Jackman drained his coffee. I'm as puzzled as you as to why the family are still so adamant after all these years. And if it's not the family behind the deaths, someone else also believes that Brendan Simmons was wrongly convicted.
Someone who loved him, maybe,
murmured Marie.
A woman? Gary asked. Surely not.
Marie shrugged.
Why not? But it can't be. We know for a fact that it was a man hounding Seaton. The neighbour saw him visiting just before Seaton disappeared.
Rosie added,
men are capable of loving other men in any number of ways. I'm thinking hero worship, comradeship, brotherly love, apart from the straightforward good old-fashioned sexual sort.
I agree,
Max added.
You would have to have very strong feelings indeed to keep up a hate campaign like this one for so long. Why wait all this time? Asked Charlie. Why not start to even the score immediately after Brendan killed himself? It's been 20 years since his suicide.
He's got a point, sir, said Gary. I know all about revenge being a dish best served cold, but why let the people you hold responsible have 20 good years of life and freedom? There could be a valid reason. Maybe he's been in prison. He might have sat in jail plotting retribution until he was let out, Jackman said. Marie looked pensive.
I keep thinking about that terrible quote of his, about seizing and dashing your little ones against the rocks. Couldn't this really be a calculated long-term plan, something truly terrible? What if the killer waited until his targets had something really precious in their lives so he could use that against them?
Could anyone be that wicked?
Asked Rosie.
Then added quickly, Don't answer that. I know the answer.
The big question is, does it end here? Jackman exhaled. The two witnesses and the prosecutor are dead. Is that enough for him?
I suspect not.
Robbie looked grim.
Me neither.
Marie folded up the empty pizza boxes.
This whole thing just screams insanity, and no one can second-guess what a psychopath will do next.
Laura could give us her opinion, volunteered Jackman.
Remember her old mentor, Professor Sam Page? He's a retired psychologist specializing in memory. Maybe he could give us some input, too.
The thought of seeing Laura again gave Jackman goosebumps.
Robbie nodded.
Good idea, sir. It will be good to get some insight into the kind of person we're dealing with.
Surely it has to be one of Brendan's family.
Max balled up a paper serviette and lobbed it at a waste paper bin, smiling when it went in.
I like the idea of a stricken, lovelorn, lost soul, but it's much more likely to be a blood relative wanting revenge, isn't it?
It certainly could be, which is why we will be interviewing them. And when we do, mind, it's eggshells all the way. The super says they're tricky, and I didn't like the look in her eye when she said it. Charlie leaned back in his chair.
Sir, regarding the murder trial, what were the grey areas you mentioned?
Jackman glanced at the clock.
Don't you guys have homes to go to? Annie and her cleaning staff are waiting to come in.
Max shrugged.
10 more minutes won't make too much difference.
Briefly, then, the teenager was found in a wooded copse on the edge of the town. She had been beaten and then strangled. Brendan never denied seeing Lindsay that night and admitted that they had made love. He was adamant that it was consensual and that they had been planning it for weeks. It was her first time.
And her last?
Whispered Rosie.
Poor kid.
Exactly. Brendan flatly denied killing her. He said they had planned to leave the area separately in case they were seen together, which they didn't want. He swore that she was alive when he left her. Alive and happy.
Gary frowned.
So, if they were so careful to keep this a secret, how come Sarah and Suri saw them? You said they were eyewitnesses.
There had been a party that evening, a very clandestine affair arranged by a couple of young men from Brendan's village. They'd broken into a disused stable at the back of one of the lads' homes, and because his parents were away for the weekend, they organised drink and some music and invited a select few girls from Nettleby. Lindsay was invited, along with Sarah and Suri. But Lindsay only stayed for a very short time. Her two friends went out to look for her and thought they saw Brendan's motorcycle hidden in a small stand of trees. They sneaked into the copse and saw Lindsay and Brendan together. The girls admitted giggling together when they realised that they were actually going to do it, as they put it.
And curiosity got the better of them,
said Rosie.
They were both still virgins. They said that they knew they ought to leave, but they were so fascinated they stayed to watch.
Jackman could picture the stifled giggles and the wide, disbelieving eyes.
When it was over, they slipped away before they were noticed. But when Lindsay didn't come back to the party, they started to get worried. After a while, they went back. And that was when they saw Brendan's bike heading off. Then, they found Lindsay dead, in the same spot she had been in with Brendan earlier.
Max pulled a face.
That didn't exactly sound like rape to me. Surely the girl had consented. Wouldn't the girls have seen if it was rape?
That's what Brendan said. But the post-mortem found considerable bruising and damage.
It was decided that what the witnesses saw was only part of what happened. It seems that he wanted more. Lindsay objected, and he raped her. She would have called out for help, and he silenced her by hitting and then strangling her. Then he ran away.
Phew, Charlie grimaced. Nasty.
The forensic evidence was undeniable. Brendan's was the only DNA found.
And the two girls saw them together, Marie concluded, and also saw Brendan leaving the scene later. Case closed.
Except that they never actually saw him hurt her. What they described was an inexperienced attempt at lovemaking.
I hate to get too personal, but initially, did he actually...
Gary asked tentatively. Jackman nodded. Yes, he scored.
If they were, as he said, planning this event, Max asked, wouldn't he have used protection?
He did, but he made a serious beginner's error and put it on wrong.
Disaster. Rosie winced and shook her head.
Jackman nodded. And that was what put the nail in his coffin. He looked up at the wall clock. Now, I really think we should call it a day. Tomorrow, we'll get an action plan together and tackle this head on. We cannot afford to let this killer melt into the shadows. We have to identify him and apprehend him. And to do that, we have to take this murder case to pieces. He pointed to the pile of thick files on the desk in front of him. He's hidden in here, somewhere. We need to dig him out before he does any more damage.
He sat on top of the pillbox and gazed across the dark marshland. There was a hint of dampness in the air. A thin, misty sea fret was coming in, but he didn't mind. As long as it was silent, devoid of any trace of humanity, he was happy. He hadn't meant to come here tonight, but a strange, uncomfortable sensation had invaded him. A feeling of being trapped in his own home, in his own skin. The next thing he knew, he was riding across the fen on his powerful motorbike, heading towards the seclusion of this wild and miserable spot that he had come to rely on when the church was closed. Earlier, he had felt almost manic with delight. If he closed his eyes, he could still see the sublime terror on the faces of the two women the moment before they jumped. The feeling of power had never left him, and he knew he would never forget it. With the lawyer, too. It hadn't been the death that excited him. It had been his control over that man. He had him take to the streets, made him sleep on cold, hard pavements, despite his fastidiousness. He sighed contentedly. As soon as you understood what really mattered to a person, then you had control over them. The actual death had been something of a letdown, although it had been amusing to watch those shaky little trial cuts before making the final killing slice. He hadn't wanted to step in, but by then it was getting tedious, and he didn't want any of those nosy street people coming across them. No. Best, by far, was the prosecutor's reaction when he destroyed his beautiful possessions and his fragile memories. The pain, the pleading and begging, and then the dandy's degradation at having to ask the Salvation Army for clothes. So satisfying. Over time, he had managed to compel the smug prosecutor to desert all his affluent friends, sell his three-story townhouse and go scurrying to that desolate spot deep in the fens, to a place where he knew no one and, more importantly, no one knew him. The women had paid the ultimate price for what they did so many years ago, but the prosecutor had truly suffered. He hoped that Brendan and Lindsay were somewhere above, looking down. He hoped they understood that he was gathering in the sinners and making them pay. He sometimes pictured the two of them as avenging angels, fire flying from their pointing fingers and fearsome golden lights flashing from their scornful eyes. After all these years, hot tears still formed behind his eyelids when he thought of Lindsay.
After she was gone, he had believed his life was over too. But like a miracle, her passing had made him rise, a phoenix emerging from the ashes of her death. He had found the strength and courage to mould a new identity from the wreck of a child that he had once been. And what a man he had become. A man capable of sowing the seeds of destruction in the minds of others. A man of power. A man of infinite patience. He kicked his heels against the lichen-covered sides of the old concrete pillbox and stared unseeing into the shadows that drifted over the marsh. Suddenly, he realized that this wasn't the finale he had planned for, but just the beginning. He was far from finished. How far would his powers take him? Murder and the motives behind it had always fascinated him. He had read extensively on the subject, and had come to the conclusion that he was quite different from others who killed. All the studies described killers as lacking in human feelings and emotions. In order to function in society, they had to emulate what they saw in others, and some became good at it. But he did have emotions, and they were deep. He could communicate. He attracted people to him, and they admired his drive and conviction, shared his beliefs. He was no loner. He was curious and outgoing. His house was open to all, and he had any number of friends. He was nothing like the men and women he had read about. He was simply different. And that alone gave him enormous power. Thoughts of power led him to consider his last experiment. This particular plan of vengeance had taken a very unusual turn. The police knew nothing about it yet, although they would probably bump into it fairly soon. The longer it took them to find, the nastier it would be for them. Now to his next target. He had one other planned demise, but after that? Which one would give him the most pleasure to bring down and destroy? He was here tonight to settle the matter, or at least narrow his selection to two or three. He wiped the chilly droplets of rain from his face, and supposed that, like so much in life, in the end it all came down to love. Chapter 15. Each night, as darkness shrouded Raynham Lodge, Ella grew nervous. It made no difference whether James was there or not. It was up to her to keep Miles and Ryan safe. She felt all right when Jackman was there, but tonight he wasn't around, and she didn't know if he was coming. Ella finished ironing the boys' school clothes and put the board away. No matter what she did to distract herself, her thoughts flew back to Sarah. Had she really taken her own life to protect her sons? Ella was convinced that the answer to this was yes. Sarah worshipped her children. If someone had threatened their lives, she wouldn't have hesitated for a moment. She would have put them first. Deep in thought, Ella set down the iron to cool. Sarah's suicide was a selfless act, but it was also very risky. The man who had been hounding her was undoubtedly a psychopath, and most probably a liar. She could have died for nothing, having left her children in an even more vulnerable position. Ella shivered. This was a bad way to think when you were alone. Maybe she should ring Jackman. He had asked her to, if she felt concerned about anything, but she was reluctant to interrupt his work just because she felt a bit spooked. He needed to throw every ounce of energy into finding the man who drove Sarah to her death. She went back into the lounge and looked around for something to do. She was far too restless to concentrate on TV or listen to music. Perhaps she should use this time to tidy some drawers and cupboards. She had James's full permission to do whatever she wanted, and she might find something interesting. So why not? An hour later, Ella was sitting at the kitchen table, staring at an old-fashioned Olympus pearl corder. She had found a microcassette inside, and despite desperately wanting to listen to it, hadn't yet pressed play. It had to be Sarah's. Ella had found it in a shoebox with some other personal stuff of hers. For some reason, Ella couldn't bring herself to listen to her friend's voice. Instead, she made a cup of tea, and while it cooled, she rang Jackman. Maybe he should be the first one to hear it. It could be nothing at all, a collection of favourite recipes or something. It could also be Sarah's deepest thoughts, recorded at the lowest, darkest point of her life. It was almost 10:30 when Jackman arrived. Even though Ella knew he was dying to listen to the recording, first he asked about his nephews. She told him briefly about Ryan, but added that she would speak to James if she became really worried. Now to the pearl quarter.
I haven't touched it. I use disposable gloves to replace the batteries.
Jackman smiled.
Once a socko, always a socko.
This time the reference to her earlier job didn't hurt. Jackman pressed play. It was bad enough hearing Sarah's voice, but far worse was what she said. Ella sank onto her chair and stared at the little machine.
I know what I saw. We weren't lying, neither of us. So why is he saying that we were?
The voice was strained. She was obviously close to tears.
And why is he punishing us? Why is he saying such terrible things? Making such horrible threats. What does he want from us? We can't say anything different today to what we said all those years ago. We can't say something other than the truth, can we?
There was a long pause, and the sound of Sarah blowing her nose. When she spoke again, she sounded calmer.
I'm going to leave this recording with my things, just in case the worst happens. If you find it, give it to my brother-in-law, Rowan Jackman. He will know what to do with this information. Perhaps it might help him to understand. He will want to understand, I know that. When I was almost 16, my friend Pauline and I watched another friend called Lindsay and a boy called Brendan making love in the woods. Half an hour later, we found her dead body and we saw Brendan running away. We told the police and... Sorry, Jackman. It was the worst thing we ever did. We should have kept what we saw to ourselves. Apart from the trial, which was pure hell, Brendan's family threatened us. And now someone, we don't know who, is persecuting us, saying we're liars and whores and deceivers. He says we must pay the price for perjuring ourselves and...
They heard her gulp as she fought back a sob.
And this was after we'd been living new lives for 20 years. How he found us, I have no idea. But if anyone is interested, my real name is Heather Miller, and I was a witness for the prosecution in the trial of Brendan Simmons.
Jackman switched off the tape.
Are you all right? You look very pale.
It's such a shock, that's all. To hear it from her own lips. It's like she's talking directly to you.
Ella stood up and went to fill the kettle.
I could do with a hot drink. Tea or coffee?
Tea, please, and yes, it's horrible.
But thanks to you, we are now in no doubt about what happened. He looked at the recorder.
I think you've heard enough. I'll listen to the rest later.
She turned to face him.
No, Jackman, I need to hear it. I need to know what kind of man is out there, possibly watching Sarah's children. I have to know what we're dealing with.
To her relief, he nodded.
I understand that.
He looked at her intently.
But I really don't think he's watching this house. And as I said before, if we think that for one moment any of you are in danger, you'll be straight out of here, I promise.
They spent the next half hour drinking tea and listening to Sarah's account of how, after Brendan killed himself, both she and Pauline were mercilessly bullied and picked on until life became unbearable. Their names had been withheld at the trial, but it was a small town, and Brendan's village was even smaller. People knew exactly what had happened and who was involved. In the end, they ran away. They were well into their teens by that time, and they moved down to the south of the county and rented a flat together. Still scared, they changed their names, managed to get jobs, and became Sarah and Suri, two young women who had a future again. In Sarah's words, "You always live in a kind of parallel world when something like this happens." But in the end, she found a loving husband, wonderful friends, and after she had Ryan and Miles, the only place she wanted to be. Then, when she had almost reached the point of no longer looking over her shoulder, he came along, and the nightmare began all over again. Only this time it was 100 times worse. Jackman paused the tape and took a deep breath.
It's hard to imagine how she managed to transform herself so successfully.
I would never have known that she had such terrible secrets, and I'm a detective.
Me neither. And I worked for her, and we were friends.
Ella swallowed.
Sometimes I felt like I was her only really close friend. She seemed so warm, so grateful for the time I spent with her.
It looks as though she and her friend Pauline didn't see too much of each other after they settled down to family life.
Maybe it was too painful, being reminded of their past. I think I'd want to make a clean break too, wouldn't you?
Possibly, although you never forget a thing like that. There are so many little triggers that would bring it all rushing back. For the sake of my sanity, I think I'd want to keep the person who suffered alongside me really close. He leaned forward and rested his elbows on the table.
As far as I can gather, Sarah only ever made one mistake, and that was mentioning the name Pauline Grover to you.
She never realized it. It was just thrown into a casual conversation and forgotten. She certainly never mentioned knowing anyone called Suri.
Jackman sat back.
Are you up to hearing the rest of it?
Ella nodded.
Let's do it. We've come this far.
The last part of the tape was nothing less than harrowing. It was very disjointed and clearly recorded over a period of time. Sarah described the horror of being threatened, and worse than that, of her children being threatened too. She regretted smashing her laptop and hoped that someone other than her husband or children would find this recording. She was clearly close to breaking point, and Ella felt quite sick by the end of it. Her last words were just, "Please forgive me." And then the tape came to an end. They sat in silence for a while. Then Ella said,
"He's the most wicked man, isn't he?"
Jackman sighed.
"I can sometimes understand murder when it's done in anger, in the heat of the moment. If, say, someone you love has betrayed you, it's never excusable, but at least I can see how it happens. Anyone can break if the pressure is too great to cope with. But such shocking callousness and premeditation is beyond my comprehension. I'm almost afraid to meet him. He's the very epitome of evil."
Ella had the odd feeling that the killer saw his actions as being just and righteous, as if it was his sworn duty to right a terrible wrong, like a crusader. She explained this to Jackman. He agreed rather doubtfully.
"The problem is, we don't know what this terrible wrong is, other than that it revolves around Lindsay and Brendan. Was it one or both of them that lit his fuse? Who or what is he trying to provide posthumous atonement for?"
He shook his head.
"There is so much more to all this. Things we know nothing about. We have a long way to go before we can look this man in the eye."
That was something Ella hoped she would never have to do. Jackman stood up.
"I'm sorry, Ella, I have to go home tonight. There are things to deal with back at Mill Corner, and I've an early start tomorrow. Will you be okay?"
"James will be back from a meeting with your father quite soon, and yes, I'll be fine, don't worry."
"I do worry."
He looked at her. Ella wondered why such a good and eligible man was single. She watched him go, feeling rather sad for him. He should be going home to a loving hug and warm bed, not to deal with things. Probably stuff like leaving money for his daily help and putting the bins out. What a waste. Ella closed the door and heard his car drive away. She had said she was fine, but she wasn't. She would have been much happier if Jackman had stayed. Chapter 16. For once, Ruth Crook made no mention of Jackman leaving the investigation. He had cornered her in her office just before the morning meeting.
Hearing what happened to Sarah in her own words confirms that we have a vendetta on our hands, and it's being orchestrated by a devious fanatic with considerable cunning. How you are able to brainwash another human being into taking their own life is almost beyond comprehension.
She shook her head.
He's a master manipulator, Ruth. I'm terrified to think what he will do next.
Her face was drawn and grim.
We have to assume he will continue to wreak vengeance on those closely connected to the Lindsay Ashcroft murder case. I'm going to have to take this to the Chief Super, you know. I think that everyone who was involved in incriminating Brendan Simmons has a right to be told what's happened here.
It could cause panic, but yes, I'd want to know if some murdering zealot had me in his sights.
Nevertheless, the last thing Jackman wanted was the press having a field day with such a fantastic story. He said as much to Ruth. She stared into space for a few moments, frowning.
That's very true, Rowan. If all the people connected to the case started being over-suspicious of anyone who tried to get near them, our man might well turn his attentions on us. After all, he will blame us for interfering with his crusade.
So it's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
We could draw his attention away from innocent victims and become victims ourselves, putting those closest to us in danger. A real rock-and-hard-place situation. Still, I guess that's what we're here for, isn't it? To protect life.
He looked at her.
It is, but I still need to take advice. Meanwhile, you crack on. I'm thinking that interviews with Brendan Simmons' family are going to be a priority.
Jackman nodded and stood up.
Without a doubt. Not something I'm looking forward to, but it should be sooner rather than later. After daily orders, I'll take Marie and we'll pay them a visit.
Yes, Marie will be perfect if the interview gets tricky. Good luck, Rowan, and remember what I said about them. Tread warily. They still bear a grudge.
I'm wondering how much to tell them. What do you think?
I'll leave that to you. You'll need to gauge their reactions, but I know you'll be diplomatic.
Jackman returned to the CID room. It was almost time for the meeting, but he wanted to tell Marie about Sarah's recording before he spoke to everyone. Marie was sitting at her desk, staring at her computer screen. She looked up as he approached.
Still with us?
She asked hopefully.
Ruth isn't still twitchy about you as OIC, is she?
Fingers crossed, the super seems pretty okay with it at present.
He moved closer and lowered his voice.
And that's mainly because I've found a witness who confirms categorically that Sarah was literally being hounded to death.
Marie's eyes widened.
Really? Who?
Sarah.
What? He took a breath.
She left a tape recording. Ella found it and rang me last night. It's pretty harrowing, but there's no doubt about what happened. It's most certainly to do with Lindsay Ashcroft's murder. I'm going to play it to the team, but I wanted you to know first.
Appreciated.
Marie stared at him.
So are we looking at the aggrieved family Simmons as suspects?
They are first in line to be interviewed, and you, my friend, have the honour of accompanying me immediately after the meeting.
I'm overwhelmed at your kind offer, though I'd be very happy to let someone else have the pleasure.
Me too. But sadly, the buck stops with us. Ruth's orders.
Bugger.
And here I was thinking my sparkling personality would more than compensate.
Sorry, boss, but no, it doesn't.
She glanced up at the clock.
Time to go address the troops.
Jackman gave Robbie, Max and Rosie the job of finding everything they could about the Lindsay Ashcroft trial. Charlie and Gary were to look into why Brendan Simmons hanged himself. Jackman and Marie drove up to the north of the county to speak to the Simmons family.
I've never been to this part.
Marie overtook a slow-moving vehicle and put her foot down.
Nettleby Oaks sounds like quite a small village.
Jackman nodded. I've not been there either, but from reading some of the transcripts, it sounds more like a hamlet. I looked it up before we left Salton, and the area is very rural, not like the Fens, but still sparsely populated. Nettleby is a bigger village. It has a school, a few shops, and a couple of places to eat.
And that's where Lindsay came from?
Asked Marie.
That's right. What do we know about the Simmons family, Jackman?
I had a brief look at a couple of old reports, but apart from all the press coverage of their fight to clear Brendan's name, there wasn't much on the people themselves.
They're a tight-knit bunch.
From day one, they were adamant that Brendan was wrongly convicted. Jackman exhaled.
According to Ruth, there were quite a few coppers who agreed with them.
Even in the face of all that forensic evidence? That's a bit odd, isn't it?
Brendan was a likable young man. He never denied having sex with Lindsay. He just swore he never hurt her.
Some of the interviewing officers made notes on their records that he seemed genuinely devastated about the girl's death. One or two were never completely convinced that he was guilty.
And the family? What are they like?
Marie turned onto the B road that would take them to Nettleby. Jackman opened his notebook.
The father has passed away since the trial. That leaves the mother, Sheila Simmons, and three brothers, Dale, Kenny, and Liam, and two daughters, Yvette and Susie.
He stared at his notes.
And there is also a small band of loyal friends who supported them throughout the trial, and still do, as far as I can make out.
Are we walking into the lion's den?
I think that sums it up, Marie. We need to be extremely wary.
Lovely. Maybe they'll be out.
She paused.
Surely they don't all live at home, do they? They must be well into their 30s and 40s by now.
Two, Kenny and Susie are married, but I have no idea about the others. According to our records, Dale and Liam are still registered at the mother's address, but I've no idea whether they actually live there.
But they still keep up the campaign.
Jackman nodded.
They have never given up, not for a single day.
This doesn't bode well, does it? I can see why we need to be uber diplomatic.
When they finally found Nettleby Oaks, the description, Hamlet, seemed an exaggeration. Five House Lane, where the Simmons family lived, was just that. A leafy lane with five farm cottages clustered together, overlooking a tapestry of tree-lined fields.
Bit different to our part of the county,
murmured Marie, bringing the car to a halt.
Prettier, but I definitely prefer our wide-open spaces.
They walked up to number two, and Jackman rang the bell. They heard people moving around inside, but it was a while before anyone answered. The woman who opened the door looked at them suspiciously. She was short and plump, with short dark brown hair and hazel eyes. She was wearing faded jeans, a man's shirt, and a V-neck sweater.
Yes?
She stood waiting, hands on hips.
It's the bloody police, Sue. You can tell the mile off.
A tall man came up behind the woman. His expression, too, was far from welcoming.
What do you lot want?
Jackman forced a smile, and he and Marie showed them their warrant cards.
You are right, sir. We are the police. We need to speak to Mrs. Sheila Simmons on a matter of some urgency. Is she at home?
Unless you come to tell us that our brother's name has been cleared, no, she isn't.
And you are Dale or Kenny?
Asked Jackman. Liam, he knew, was younger than this man.
Dale Simmons. But none of us wants to talk to you, so I suggest you just sod off.
He made to close the door, but the woman put her hand on his arm.
Shut up, Dale. They said it was urgent. The least you can do is listen to what they have to say.
They've never said anything important before,
Dale grumbled. He turned his back on them.
You talk to them if you want, but leave me out.
I'm Susie. You'd better come in.
She led the way to a small sitting room, crammed with furniture. Sofas, armchairs, dining chairs, and beanbags took up every square inch. Sue gestured to a seat.
Sorry about my brother. He still feels very strongly.
as we all do, that the police let us down badly.
The case was before my time, Susie. But I have to say that we do respect your family for continuing to campaign for your brother Brendan.
Susie's expression softened very slightly.
He never killed that girl, Detective. He was a sweet, sweet boy. He couldn't even put an injured bird out of its misery. And he cried for days when our dog died. You never knew him, but I did. I loved my brother, and I know, deep in my heart, that he never hurt Lindsay Ashcroft. He just wasn't capable of it.
She was clearly sincere, but her love for her brother didn't make him an innocent man.
Susie, we really need to speak to your mother. Is that possible? Marie asked. It's very important.
Susie looked uncertain.
Our mum, she's ill. Very ill. I don't want her bothered. Can't you tell me? And maybe... No. I'll get Yvette and Kenny. They are with Mum now. Whatever you have to say, you can tell us together.
She left the room. Jackman frowned at Marie. They're all here. Even the married ones. What does that tell you?
That the mother is dying, Marie said flatly. Ever felt like a sitting duck?
Never so much as right now, he whispered. This, as the super said, is going to be tricky.
Susie came back into the room, alone.
Mum wants you both to go up and see her, but...
We'll try not to tire her out, I promise.
Jackman looked at her, his expression compassionate.
She's very poorly, isn't she?
Susie's eyes filled with tears.
She's not got long. She swallowed loudly. But she's a very strong woman, and she says she wants to hear what you have to say.
They followed Susie up a steep staircase and into the front bedroom. It was uncomfortably warm. Jackman saw a small open fire on the far side of the room burning brightly in a cast-iron grate. Sheila Simmons was propped up in bed against a mound of pillows. Her face was sallow and gaunt, but her eyes were shrewd and bright. Susie pointed to a tall and skinny, dark-haired woman. Like her sister, she wore faded jeans and a sweater.
This is Yvette and my brother Kenny.
She gestured to a rather mousy man who sat close to his mother holding her hand.
Mum, this is G.I. Jackman and D.S. Marie Evans. They are from Salt and Le Fen and they want to talk to you.
Get them something to sit on.
The old woman's voice was cracked but strong. Her tone said she was used to having her orders obeyed. Susie scurried off and returned with two straight-back chairs. Jackman noted that Dale was not in the room, but he suspected that the older son was still somewhere within earshot. The other brother, Liam, was absent. He coughed.
Mrs. Simmons, we won't take too much of your time. There has been a rather disturbing development in Salton, and it appears to be connected to the murder of Lindsay Ashcroft. Hence we felt the need to come in person and explain what's happened.
Is this development something that could lead to my son's name being cleared?
At this stage, Mrs. Simmons, we are very much in the dark about what it means. I can't give you false hope.
I thought not.
The woman sighed.
Okay, get it over with. What's it all about?
Jackman glanced at Marie. She nodded very slightly. He explained that someone had taken the law into his own hands and was causing the deaths of people involved in the prosecution of Brendan. No one in the stuffy hot room spoke. Dale burst into the room, shouting,
So now you're accusing us of murder too, you pigs. You're not satisfied with wrongly accusing my brother and sending him to his death. You now come here accusing us of taking the law into our own hands and executing the people who put my brother behind bars.
His eyes were wide and his nostril flared in anger. Then he stood with his hands at his sides, apparently at a loss for words, swearing under his breath.
If you've finished...
His mother looked at him hard.
I think that's quite enough of that.
You'd be just as angry if they didn't tell you, Dale, So let's listen, shall we?
Vivette said. Jackman thought she seemed the most reasonable of the lot. Dale slumped back against the far wall.
It was necessary to warn you about this, Mrs. Simmons, as we'll naturally have to make inquiries. Please be assured we're not targeting you or your family. We will be speaking to dozens of people involved in the old case.
The old woman nodded and asked Kenny for a drink of water.
How are these people being killed, Detective Inspector? And who has died?
Jackman hesitated. They would see it in the news before long anyway, so we might as well tell them.
The two unnamed witnesses who were only teenagers at the time, and the prosecuting barrister, are dead. Someone hounded and terrorized them until they took their own lives.
There was a collective intake of breath. Yvette whispered,
Oh, dear God. Heather and Pauline, both dead.
Marie spoke softly.
One drowned, and the other fell to her death. You knew them?
Kenny looked up at them.
Of course we did. It's a small community, isn't it? We always knew. But after the trial, door came out anyway. It's true, we did make life hard for them, but...
Sheila Simmons shifted uncomfortably in her bed.
This is terrible news, officers. For their families, of course. But it's also devastating for us. We will be the obvious suspects. People will think that we've finally decided to take our revenge. The whole thing will flare up again and we'll lose the goodwill of all the people that believed in our cause.
She coughed, and the sound was rasping and painful, and she sipped more water.
We should leave.
Jackman stood up. But please, if there's anything you can do to help us, anyone you know of who's ever shown signs of being fanatical about what happened, and I don't mean committed, as your family is, I mean seriously overzealous, please do contact us. We'll leave you our details, and as I said, we will need to talk to all of you very soon. We'll phone and make arrangements. He gave the old lady the warmest smile he could muster. I'm sorry we've tired you. Please accept our sincere apologies. He thought he heard a snort of derision from Dale, but Sheila Simmons nodded.
I appreciate you coming. Even though your news is far from good, we'll think about what you've asked.
In the hall, Jackman gave Susie his card.
This person is ruthless. We have to catch him. I'm just sorry that we'll have to come back for detailed statements regarding all your whereabouts. Please do understand they will be as much as to prove your innocence and to rule you out of our inquiries as to assign blame, okay?
Susie nodded.
Why? After all this time, why now?
We don't know, but we fear he hasn't finished.
Jackman's voice was like granite. As she closed the door, he noticed that Susie looked sickly white. Back in the car, Jackman let out a long breath.
Did I do the right thing, telling them so much?
There was no other way, Jackman. You did what you had to do, and I think the old lady really did appreciate it.
She might still believe that Brendan was innocent, but she's no psycho killer. Not that I can be quite so sure of the wild-eyed son, Dale. Marie pulled a face.
He's a bit of a firecracker, isn't he?
Jackman gave a short laugh.
You can say that again. I'll be very interested to get each of them on their own.
Marie started the engine.
You and me both, Gov. I can hardly wait.
Chapter 17.
Something bothering you, Sunshine?
Max gave Rosie's shoulder a gentle squeeze.
Just worried.
Rosie didn't react to Max's touch.
About? This man, this deviant.
She turned and looked at Max.
The criminals we usually get don't bother me. I can see what makes someone rob, deceive, beat people up, and generally behave badly in certain situations. Sometimes I can even get their reasons for killing. But this guy...
She gave a shudder.
This guy is off the scale. He scares me.
Max pressed her shoulder again.
Hey, come on.
Where's my fearless girl?
He's just another crazy.
Hell, we've had our fair share of them over the years, haven't we?
I know we have. But he's different. You must be able to see that.
Rosie sounded almost accusing. Mildly concerned, Max sat down beside her.
This wasn't the Rosie he knew. Of course I can see it, Flower. But I'm not giving him the satisfaction of getting under my skin. He's an evil bastard, and I hope we nail him before he turns someone else's mind into mush.
I hate the thought of someone taking advantage of another person's weaknesses. It's so cruel.
Max nodded.
Mindbenders. They've got no moral values at all.
Rosie frowned.
I'm not sure he sees himself like that. I've been looking at the messages he left Sarah, and I swear he believes that he has some kind of divine right to punish the wrongdoers. Sure, we realize it's all to do with the Ashcroft murder. But is he on a crusade to avenge the murder of Lindsay, or to avenge the conviction and subsequent death of Brendan Simmons?
Max scratched his head.
We need to know a lot more about that trial, don't we?
Exactly.
Rosie grimaced.
Until we know what he's killing for, we won't know where to look for him.
What if he's just picked on that case simply because he felt that there was a serious miscarriage of justice? He may have no connections with anyone.
Max shrugged.
Wait, he might know it was a wrong verdict because he knew the real killer. He could even be the killer and has been cheated out of his notoriety.
Rosie stared at Max.
Is that a possibility or am I just sleep deprived?
It's a possibility, but we need to keep digging.
Do you see Cohen? Do you see McKeldry? Ruth Crook stood in the doorway. Her face was set. I need you to follow something up for me. Max and Rosie jumped up and hurried over to the superintendent.
Mom?
In the absence of D.I. Jackman and Marie, I need to pass something on to your team. It has been decided to tell all those who are involved in the Ashcroft trial that they could be in danger and to take precautions.
Max nodded. Fair point, Mom. They have a right to know if they're under threat.
The jurors have been contacted and several people from the original prosecuting team, plus the judge who presided and passed sentence. But one man is missing from the list. We cannot locate the foreman of the jury, and to be frank, as the man who delivered the guilty verdict, he could well be the next victim.
You want us to find him, Mom?
Asked Rosie. As fast as possible, D.C. McKeldry. Unless you think our man has finished playing judge, jury and executioner.
No, Super. I don't think he's finished at all, Rosie said. Don't worry, we'll find him.
The superintendent gave them the memo with a name and an address on it, turned and strode towards the lifts.
The words, "What part of as fast as possible, don't you understand?"
floated back to them in her wake. Max and Rosie hurried back to their desks.
I always said she had eyes in the back of her bleeding head, grumbled Max.
I see where she's worried, though. She might have a point about this man, she looked at the memo, Isaac Whitman being next in line.
And we'd better get to him, hadn't we, before our mighty Avenger does a mind fuck on him.
Rosie winced but made no comment. She grabbed her bag.
We have an address in Horncastle. Let's start there, shall we? I'll drive.
Wilco.
Patting his pockets for his phone, Max hurried after her. Gary stared at the results of the inquest on Brendan Simmons and shook his head.
Poor little devil, he murmured.
You are talking about a convicted killer, Gary. Should I be worried about you?
Charlie Button looked up from his screen.
Maybe, maybe not.
You doubt the verdict?
Charlie spun his chair around to face Gary.
I see grey areas and I hate grey areas.
Gary swiped the printout with the back of his hand.
Guilty or not, this kid had never been in trouble before. Then he's thrown into the deep end of a Cat A prison. Not just any Cat A, but one that houses some of the most dangerous male prisoners in the country. No wonder he cracked.
The inquest states that his death was given as asphyxia due to compression of the neck following hanging from a ligature. How on earth did he manage that?
Charlie frowned.
Torn-up shirt fashioned into a rope secured round his neck, then the other end tied to the top bunk. Not difficult if you are desperate, and the blood can be cut off in as little as 7 seconds, so you pass out and then die.
Charlie grimaced.
That's horrendous.
The governor's report states that Brendan hadn't reported any abuse or given them any cause to monitor his safety,
Gary snorted.
Not surprised. He'd have been too bloody scared to report anything. I can't even imagine the emotional stress he went through.
Gary, what you said about grey areas, do you really think that lad might have been innocent?
Charlie asked.
Gary sat back in his chair. Son, I hope he was guilty because then his fate would in some way be justified. But if, just if, he had told the truth, then I can totally understand why his family have carried a torch for him all these years.
They say that unless you are a chronic recidivist, being incarcerated is pure hell on a lot of levels. So if you were jailed for something you really hadn't done, well,
Charlie shrugged, it would blow your mind.
And prisons are high-crime areas. The amount of drug dealing, theft, robbery, assaults, threats of violence and sexual abuse is much greater than on the outside.
And if you were squeaky clean when you went in, it would be the shock to end all shocks,
said Charlie thoughtfully.
Gary shuffled some papers on his desk and pulled out a note with a name and address on it.
I checked this out earlier. It's the contact details of an old lag I helped put away years back. Mackey finally saw the error of his ways, and after spending half his life in various prisons, he went straight. I've calculated that he was inside in the same prison at the time when Brendan Simmons took his own life. It's a big prison, but news travels like wildfire in those places. I'm going to see if he remembers anything in particular about Brendan.
He stood up and reached for his jacket. Hold the fort, Charlie. He only lives on the other side of town. I won't be long.
Mackie Cairns clearly wasn't over the moon to find Gary on his doorstep, but reluctantly invited him in. They went into a small sitting room that housed a television, a battered coffee table, a faded beanbag and a shabby sofa. Gary wasn't offered tea, but from a quick glance into the kitchenette on the way in, he decided that was lucky.
I'm not after information, Mackie.
Well, not the sort of thing I'm usually after.
I just wondered if you could recall if there was any funny business going on up in Durham when Brendan Simmons hanged himself.
Gary laid a £10 note on the coffee table.
There's always funny business going on in the big house, PC Pritchard. You should know that.
Mackie was a tall, heavy man with unruly hair and a craggy face. After his last stint inside, he had abruptly turned his back on crime and got himself a job as a mechanic in a local garage. Considering that one of his past vocations had been as a getaway driver, he knew plenty about cars. Plus, he had kept his hand in while in prison, studying engineering. Gary steeled himself for the usual banter before he got an answer, but this time Mackie seemed almost reflective when he spoke about Brendan Simmons.
There was a strange atmosphere in the place around the time that lad was brought in.
Mackie eased himself down onto the beanbag, allowing Gary to have the sofa.
And as you well know, no one's guilty in prison. They all swear they never did it. But Brendan divided the inmates. Some of them decided he was a baby-faced assassin, a rapist and a killer. End of story. Others thought he was either a bloody good actor, or he really was innocent.
Gary nodded. It was much like that on the outside, Mackie. Two camps.
Yeah, but everything is so much more intense in the slammer. Things get out of proportion, then they turn nasty.
And did things get bad for the kid?
He was a pretty boy, PC Pritchard. I don't need to spell out what that means, do I?
Gary shook his head.
No, you don't. Thing is, Someone took a fancy to him. But Brendan wasn't having any, and he made an enemy of a very nasty man indeed. Then someone else took him under his wing, but I never believed it was out of kindness. I thought it was to get one over on Brendan's first admirer. Whatever, it screwed Brendan's head up even more.
I notice you forgot to mention the names, Mackie.
No, PC Pritchard. I didn't forget.
Point taken.
Gary knew not to pursue it. He grinned.
As a matter of interest, which camp were you in?
Mackie shifted his bulk on the unstable beanbag.
After all the years I've clogged up in the can, I think I've learned to read between the lines.
He looked up at Gary.
If he killed that girl, I'm a monkey's uncle. And I'm no monkey.
Gary drew in a deep breath.
Somehow I knew you were going to say that, but I really hoped you wouldn't.
Why? Because it means that the man who did kill her is still free?
Mackie picked up the tenner and pocketed it.
That's another thing. No, it's more that Brendan, a young man with his whole life ahead of him, died for nothing, and his family have to live with the stigma of having spawned a murderer.
You're a right old softy, aren't you, PC Pritchard?
I hate injustice, Mackie, that's all.
I can still cut it with the heavy mob when I need to.
Mackie looked unconvinced.
Why all the interest after all this time?
Gary raised his eyebrows.
Can't say, Mackie. Ongoing investigation.
Mackie hesitated, then added,
This didn't come from me. But there was one other rumour going round the block at the time, and that was that Brendan's suicide was, how can I put it? Assisted.
Gary froze. There had been absolutely nothing in any of the records to suggest that Brendan's death had been anything other than a desperate measure to end his suffering.
What do you know, Mackie?
No more than what I've told you.
But if I were a betting man, I'd wager that Brendan Simmons wasn't alone in his cell when he died.
Is that even possible after lockdown? Mackie gave a hearty laugh.
It didn't happen after lockdown. And even if it had, anything is possible in prison, if you know who to bribe.
Gary left, feeling that a heavy weight had just descended on his shoulders. They moved heaven and earth to get the bad guys put away. Now he wondered exactly what kind of place they were sending them to. Jackman and Marie were busy working out a rota for the Simmons family interviews when Gary arrived back at the station. Marie frowned at him.
Oh dear, that's not a happy face.
No.
Gary flopped down into his chair.
I've just heard something very disturbing.
Jackman looked up from his computer screen.
That sounds ominous.
Gary exhaled.
Someone who was on the same block as Brendan Simmons has told me that it was suspected the lad's suicide wasn't exactly textbook. The word he used was assisted.
Shit, Marie exclaimed. But what about all the official reports? Even the family are sure he took his own life. Are you certain this source is reliable, Gary?
I'd stake my next month's pay on it being kosher, Sarge. This guy is a born-again ex-con holding down a job and keeping his nose clean. He's helped me before, and he's solid.